Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcioland podcast. And this is brought to you by our great friends at Euro Fantasy Game, the home for the best fantasy football games, including Serie A. Also a place where you can get a lot of great articles on Serie A with great offers such as Chloe Beresford, John Solano, Enrico Passarella, and yours truly. So today we have a great show for you. We're going to kick it off with Napoli, answer all your Twitter questions, including on Maldini's return. And we're going to finish the interview with a brilliant interview with our friend Richard Hall from the Gentleman Ultra. And we're going to focus more on the two clubs from Milan. At the top, I'm joined by our great friend, producer, co-host of the show, Alex Goldberg, whose videos on Twitter are absolutely blowing up. So, Alex, we haven't talked about Napoli in about, it's been about 2 weeks. So they've struggled a little bit in the preseason. I don't want to overreact to that, but I've been saying in general that I think there is some serious reason for concern for potential let down. I see a lot of red flags with this team, but maybe I'm a little bit too pessimistic. Maybe I'm swayed by the fact that Sarri, who I loved so much, left. So do you think I'm overreacting, Alex, or do you think there are some reasons why Napoli fans should be concerned?
You know what, David? I definitely do see cause for concern, but I don't think I'm as down on them as you are. And it's funny, I probably should be, right? Because Maurizio Sarri and Jorginho, two integral parts to Napoli, are now on my club, Chelsea. So if anything, I should be like, yeah, you guys lost the heart and soul of Napoli. You're screwed. But no, I am still pretty confident in Napoli. I don't think they're going to win 91 points, but I look at it like this. Carlo Ancelotti, yeah, he hasn't been as solid in league for his past couple clubs. However, he still is a manager that's been around the block. He knows what he's doing. Also, Napoli did keep a lot of their same team. They still have Lorenzo Insigne. They still have Dries Mertens. They still have Alon. They still have Hamsik. Most importantly, they still have Koulibaly. If they had lost him, I would totally be down on Napoli. But he is huge, and he is so important. Now, their goalkeeper situation, yeah, it's not great. But honestly, Pepe Reina wasn't great either. He just really fit Maurizio Sarri. But also, the other reason why I'm not totally down on Napoli has more to do with the teams around them fighting for, let's be real, fighting for second place, because we know Juventus is going to be the favorites for the Scudetto. However, Inter is great on paper. They're really damn good on paper, and I definitely do think they will be second place, or at least our top favorites for second place. Roma has definitely made some improvements, but right now they really only look good on paper. There's still a lot of new parts. I want to see how it goes together. AC Milan's got some new parts, so I want to see how it goes together. So I do favor Napoli's cohesiveness. Now, maybe second place is unrealistic. I do think third or fourth place is way more realistic for Napoli to aim for, but I don't think it's going to necessarily be as bad as you may be hinting, but I definitely do see some cause for concern. As you've said before, Jorginho is kind of the metronome of Napoli, and Sarri literally was the identity of Napoli, but I still have faith in the players they have and Carlo Ancelotti making them at least a formidable side. So, David, that's my take. What about you?
You've talked to me a little bit off the ledge, but here's a couple of things that stand out to me. We see this in the NFL. Usually the team that loses in the Super Bowl on such a huge stage, the next season struggles quite a bit. That has been a constant. And when I look at the way Napoli lost the Scudetto, they got to 91 points, a record for a team that didn't win it. They talked about what a gut punch that Higuain goal against Inter was, and they basically knew they lost the title there. So on one hand, I hear what you're saying, that it's good that they're bringing back all these players. With Inter, they look great on paper. We know that Napoli's players, and they're almost all still there, got to 91 points. But I wonder how much of a hangover there's going to be from that. Then the other thing that stands out to me is, Sarri leaving. I think he felt like the team he had peaked. It's interesting that Napoli's president, De Laurenti, said that Sarri was looking for a pretty big rebuild at the team. So maybe Sarri himself felt that he took the team as far as he could. You mentioned the goalkeeper situation. We talked about it all during last season. We hypothesized what would Napoli look if they had a great keeper like Handanovic. I actually think they managed to make the goalkeeper situation worse this season. I think Mere is a very good keeper for the future. They spent a fortune on him. He's injured already. He had some injury concerns going into the season. I think he's going to have a lot of pressure there. Carnesis, his backup, was a disaster against Liverpool. Almost everyone didn't think it was a good idea to bring him in to back up someone that's not a known quantity like Mere. Now they're talking about bringing in Ochoa, who's great in the World Cup, not so great at the club level. So I actually think they've gotten worse, and I got to give them credit in a way. I didn't think they could, but they managed. And finally, today, their new acquisition, Malkuich, shows up at his medical wearing an Odell Beckham jersey, which I quite frankly don't think is a good sign. I don't know. Do you think, Alex, that's a good omen to show up with that jersey at the medical?
No, because yes, Odell is talented, but David, he preaches instability. He preaches, yes, you should be nervous what may happen tomorrow. So no, probably not a great sign.
Okay, so that's my take, and I'd love to be proven wrong. You guys know that I have a lot of affection for Napoli. I love a lot of the players on the team, but I'm old, and when I see these red flags, I try not to ignore them. And one thing that I never ignore are the fantastic Twitter questions that we get from our listeners. And this week, you guys have really gone overboard. We got a lot of really good ones. As always, you can send questions using the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with a very popular topic within Serie A. What do you make of Maldini's return to Milan?
I can't say enough about how impressed I am by this. And I'll tell you this for a lot of reasons. I mean, A, obviously, Maldini is synonymous for Milan, probably even more than Del Piero with Juve, Zanetti with Inter. If you know about Milan's history, his dad was the captain when they won the Champions League for the first time. I mean, there's just such a great tradition there. So symbolically, I think it's great. But if you've listened to the podcast, you know that last season, I felt that Milan trotted out their legend. You know, there was links to Kaká, or this legend was visiting Casa Milan, or let's tweet about this legend. Every time something bad happened, it felt like it was kind of a way to change the subject. And I got to say, the fact that they brought back Maldini after they brought in Higuain and Caldara, already when Milan was at a high, that to me says a lot. And the other thing that stands out to me about this is Maldini had turned down the opportunity to be part of the Chinese Milan. You know, he wanted to meet the owners. He wanted to find out more about them, wanted to know what his role was going to be all about. And in the interview with Richard Hall, we'll get into more of that. Like, Maldini's not someone that's going to be used. He's a very sharp guy. His image is very important to him. And I think the fact that he decided to marry this project, and he met with the Elliott Fund in New York a few weeks ago, to me says a lot. And to me, if he's confident in this project, I think so should Milan fans. Around this time last year, I met Maldini at an event with Marcotti here in Boston. And that's one thing that I had asked him about the Chinese ownership. And he was very diplomatic, but he didn't seem to be really enthused by the project. So I think the fact that he's going there now is really great. It's not just the symbolic move. I think this really bodes very well for Milan.
It's a Maldini Monday. So David, next Twitter question. With all the Elliott Fund, UEFA, Higuain, Maldini fiesta, it's almost easy to forget what a mess Milan were just a second ago. Is the FFP thing a thing of the past for them? And can a team just start fresh with new owners?
So we got a version of this question by multiple people. Some of them flat out said, it's pretty obvious I'm an Inter fan when I'm asking this. So I respect the people that just put that out there. So look, yeah, I agree. It wasn't that long ago that, you know, Fassone, Mirabelli and the Chinese owners went with UEFA and they were told, no way, we're going to kick you out of the Europa League. Then things really changed once the Elliott Fund started backing the club. They brought in Leonardo. So it's a really 180-degree shift. But look, the reality is Milan still has restrictions. They said it today at the press conference. I think both Maldini and Leonardo pointed out that they can't spend a lot this summer. And look, with Higuain, they brought him in on loan with option to buy. The reason they structured it this way is precisely because they can't spend too much right now. They can probably make up that Higuain fee with a few minor moves before the window closes. So look, soon the Elliott Fund can try to get into a new voluntary agreement with UEFA. Let's see if they try to do it. But right now, Milan hasn't spent a lot, so that's why they're able to do the moves that they have.
All right, David, next Twitter question. What are the chances Milan sign Milinkovic-Savic, and would they be better off spending $100 million on multiple players rather than just him?
So this question was submitted before today's press conference where Leonardo said, look, we just can't afford Milinkovic-Savic right now. And I think that's the case. We never reported anything about it on Di Marzio's site. I saw one of Gianluca's colleagues tweeted that they had done some due diligence on it. There seemed to be anything concrete on that. So, yeah, I think Milan's at least a year away from making those types of moves, but they can make some other moves. I think they're going to try to close the deal for Bernard, the guy from Shakhtar that Chelsea is also pursuing. He's on a free transfer. I have a feeling they'll keep working on getting another midfielder. Today, Leonardo closed the door on Rabiot, saying there hasn't been any meetings. That's the only thing he said. So maybe there could be a meeting later on. He has a pretty close relationship with the agent of Rabiot, also his mother from his time at PSG. So I expect Milan to make, you know, a few more moves. It won't be an expensive one, but I think, you know, they're setting themselves up really well in the future to be able to make those as well.
All right, David, let's go on to another popular topic. What's the latest on Luka Modric? And if Inter failed to land him, should they move Asamoah to the midfield?
So let's start with the second part. I know it's very tempting to move Asamoah to the midfield because that was his original role at Udinese. In a pinch, we saw him do it at Juve, but I wouldn't. The reason I say that is Asamoah is a very good left wing back. I thought last season he was the best wing back on Juve, period. That has been really a problem spot for Inter for a very long time. I think, you know, Inter's might not be that deep, but they have quite a few good options in the midfield, so I wouldn't do that. As far as Modric, it's just an interesting situation because Modric, it sounds like he wants to leave. Now, this, you know, you could say this is just a way to get a new contract and he's, you know, he's older, pushing to get one last big deal. Or maybe it's similar to Ronaldo where, you know, it's like what else that he does he have left to prove at Real Madrid at this point? Ronaldo left. Maybe it's time for Madrid to open a new cycle. And the fact that Ronaldo's in Serie A, I could see how that it would be appealing for him to maybe go to Serie A as well and to square off against Ronaldo. And look, a thing that's really underrated is a lot of players really like the idea of living in Milan. Inter is a club that has very often born players that a lot of fans that don't know Serie A are surprised by. And another thing that I think helps Inter is the transfer window in the Premier League is going to close on Thursday, and Modric is scheduled to meet with Florentino Perez by Thursday. So you take the Premier League out, there's really not that many other options. I guess PSG could be after Thursday. So that's the part. So we have to see how true is it that Modric wants to leave. Now, I know a lot of people are making fun of the fact that Inter would likely have to offer a loan with option to buy to acquire Modric. I know that sounds completely ridiculous, but hey, that's the formula that Higuain went for. I know Modric is another level than Higuain, but not completely a different world away. To me, it's much more about would Real Madrid let him go? Would they say, okay, you really want a chance to get a new challenge and go elsewhere? So I wouldn't focus so much on the formula of the deal. Maybe Inter would then sell a big name, not Icardi, or I doubt Perisic, but maybe they'd make another sale to make it work. Maybe Brozovic goes. I'm just throwing it out there. So I wouldn't get so hung up on the formula. To me, the more important part is, does Modric really want to leave? Another theory that I've read out there, and then I could see some truth to this, how Jorge Mendes could really be working on a big triangle where Modric would go to Inter and Milinkovic-Savic would go to Real Madrid. Mendes has been working at as an intermediary on Lazio's behalf to try to get a huge offer from Milinkovic-Savic. And then João Mário going to Lazio as part of the deal. That doesn't sound completely ridiculous to me. I wouldn't close it out. If I had to do a percentage for Modric at Inter, I would still keep it low, maybe 20-25%. But I wouldn't exclude it altogether. I definitely think there are some factors why this isn't completely impossible.
You know, you said it on the last podcast, if Inter did get Luka Modric, and after Juventus got Cristiano Ronaldo, how badass would that be for Serie A? That would be awesome. So, David, staying on Inter, do Inter have what it takes to get to 90 points, which is probably what will be needed to seriously challenge for the Scudetto?
I think they have an outside chance of it. And again, let's really give credit to Napoli to getting to that. That was really, really impressive. Now, Napoli did that essentially punting all other competitions. And I think Inter, I'm not saying they would do it purposefully because that's not what they're about as a club. But look, they are in the fourth pot in the Champions League. They could end up being an incredibly tough group just to get out of the group. So they might get help in that sense, where they get bounced early in the Champions League. Maybe Juve is so focused on trying to win the Champions League that Inter then punts the Europa League and goes all in for the Scudetto. So I wouldn't exclude it. I think talent-wise, Inter can get there. I'm not quite sure about their depth. It's certainly not on Juve's level, but I think it's better than people give them credit for. So I'm going to say I think there's an outside chance that Inter can get to 90 points.
All right, let's move off Inter. David, how about this? What did you make of Leonardo Bonucci's farewell from Milan and reintroduction to Juventus?
So, Alex, let me ask you, how much am I dating myself if I make a Seinfeld reference? Do you think most of our listeners know what Seinfeld is?
Well, David, considering how much it's rerun, I don't think you're dating yourself at all.
Okay. So the way Bonucci left and more the way he returned to Juve made me think of one of the classic episodes in Seinfeld where George Costanza quits his job and then the next day shows up at the office like nothing happened, pretending like that never took place and he always stayed there. That really reminded me of the way Bonucci has handled his return to Juve. He's been asked, you know, to apologize. He says, you know, I'll just answer on the pitch. I thought that was like the way Costanza handled him quitting the job. I think, you know, personally, the way he sent the tweet saying that every trip ends with a return, you know, he was Milan's captain. I think he definitely owed them a little bit more. As far as the Juve part, yeah, I can agree that he can answer on the pitch. You know, maybe he owes an explanation as to why he left in the first place, but I definitely think that when it comes to Milan, he needed to do a little bit more. You'll hear in the interview with Richard Hall when we got into the relationship between Maldini and the Ultras. I do think it's going to be interesting to see how Juve fans, the Ultras especially, are going to, re-welcome Bonucci in the first match at home if he doesn't say anything and just does the talking on the pitch.
One of the best analogies so far. Absolutely love Seinfeld and love that episode. David, next Twitter question. What do you think are Juve's strengths and weaknesses compared to last season?
So, I think this might be the best attack Juve has had in my lifetime. I mean, Ronaldo, Douglas Costa, Dybala is absolutely devastating as an attack. I mean, I'm not sure how Allegri is going to fit all those three together. But that's devastating. And then you have Bernardeschi and Mandzukic as well. I mean, the days of Matri, Vucinic, Quagliarella, and Bednar are really behind us. So their attack is clearly incredible. I was a big fan of the Cancelo addition. Look, Dani Alves was great in the Champions League for Juve, very good offensive player. I'm not sure Cancelo can rise in the huge matches like Dani Alves, but I think he really gives them a big dimension offensively. So really, Juve, as far as scoring goals, is just going to be devastating. I think the midfield is better. I think Emre Can is definitely going to help. It looks like Pjanic is going to stay. I think Matuidi is going to be better in his second full season. So I think Juve is clearly better. I think a lot of the Juve fans are a little bit too depressed recently. I think Juve's fault, in a way, was making all these moves early. And now you see Milan and Inter being linked to Modric. They were linked to Vidal. I think Juve fans are a little bit in too much what have you done for me lately. But you got to be thrilled with what they've put together as a team. I think this is clearly the best Juve we've seen since the Calciopoli era.
All right, this is an interesting question, David. Is there a chance Juve makes the same mistake Inter did after winning the treble and focuses too much on older players?
Absolutely not. And first of all, once Inter started, you know, rewarding too much older players, they had already won the treble. So Juve has yet to do that. Let's do that first. I think Juve's Bonucci, to me, helps them a lot more in the short term. We beat to death that deal. There were plenty of financial reasons why Juve made that deal. But there's no way that I think Juve is going to make the same mistake as Inter. So Inter, after they won the treble, gave a lot of extensions to their older players, didn't rejuvenate the team. I think a lot of Juve fans saw Caldara leaving and are like, are we making the same mistake? I mean, look at Juve. This is a club that is not sentimental at all. I think both Buffon and Del Piero would have liked to play longer at the club. Juve was like, this is it. Time for us to move on. They're not emotional. Their sporting director, Paratici, is so good at finding young talents, much better than Inter's management was back then. Inter's management, Moratti, was so sentimental, almost to a fault. Juve is the exact opposite. I have no doubt that Paratici is going to be able to find a new Caldara. Right now, they still have Rugani. So I think there was a lot of overreactions to that deal, but I don't see at all the risk of Juve. Look, right now they do have an older team, but they want to win now. But I really have no doubt that slowly but surely they'll rejuvenate the team.
All right. I like this one. David, what are the odds Antonio Cassano makes a comeback?
I mean, define what a comeback is. You know, he went to Hellas Verona and the retreat and then retired in the middle of the retreat. I mean, granted, the summer retreats are about to end now. Could he make a cameo on a team, go to the trainings for a little bit and try to get it going? Maybe. He also could end up at Bari, you know, a historic club in Italy that went bankrupt and is starting over with De Laurentiis as an owner. And I got to tell you, that's such a great move because De Laurentiis saved Napoli from a similar situation. So maybe we see Cassano kind of at the amateur level. Maybe he can make a reality show out of it. But as far as him being on a top club, I don't see it. Not even on Parma, who's newly promoted.
All right. How about this, David? What do you make of Maurizio Sarri's attempt to keep Thibaut Courtois and Eden Hazard?
You know what I found very interesting about this? And, you know, there were some reports, and I think Sarri said this after the match yesterday, that he doesn't care so much about the agents, the families. Like, he wants to actually talk to the players and give them his vision. Like, this is very interesting because this is really a new dimension to Maurizio Sarri. He's a manager that, dating back to his time at Empoli, didn't want to be involved in transfers at all. He used to say, you know, I'm a coach, I'm a manager. Whatever players you give me, I'll work on getting the best out of them. So I find it pretty interesting, but I know you've been tweeting a lot about it, Alex. To me, this makes a lot of sense that Sarri would try to give them their vision. I have a feeling Courtois is going to be gone. I think Hazard, I'm more optimistic for you, Alex, that he'll stay. Let's see what happens. I definitely think the fact that the transfer window is closing in England soon definitely helps Chelsea's chances of keeping him. But more than anything, I find it interesting that Sarri is now trying to get more involved with transfers.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. You want to speak to these players face to face. They weren't back because of their late stay in the World Cup, they being Belgium. Courtois has a different deal than Hazard. He has less time on his deal. It expires at the end of the season. And he's got kids in Madrid. My whole thing with Eden Hazard is he has kids in London. And I think, honestly, the true colors of both players, or shall I say people, are showing. Courtois, a little bit of a snake. Eden Hazard, a really humble guy, and I'm pretty confident he will stay. That's, once again, with me not knowing anything, just me more knowing about Eden Hazard. And also, if Maurizio Sarri can just say, hey, this is what I envision in my system for you, Why the hell would he not stay? I can't wait. So, David, next Twitter question. How likely is Laxalt to join Zenit?
I actually think there's a pretty good chance of this, and this is pretty disappointing. I mean, I got nothing against Russia, but once you go over there, it's like you're kind of off the radar. I thought Laxalt even before the World Cup, and he was excellent for Uruguay, was one of the best left backs in all of Serie A. I think he would have made a lot of sense for a lot of clubs in Italy, but I do think there's a pretty good chance he goes to Zenit. His agent kind of had an agreement with Genoa that if he brought a big offer that they would let him go. But Zenit has a thing, too, for left backs from Genoa. They had Crescito for a long time. Crescito's back at Genoa. So, sadly, I could see this deal happening. And it would be a shame. I mean, not just for Serie A. It would have been nice to see him on a top team in a top league.
All right, David, this is a very interesting question. Do you think Andrea Belotti's level is closer to the 16-17 season or last season?
We get a lot of questions on Belotti, which I find really fascinating. I think there's a lot of fans who are like really like to stick it to Torino and be like, haha, you were greedy. Now you're stuck with the player. You could should have sold them. And so, you know, looking at it, I mean, long and short of it, I think he's definitely closer to the 16-17 season than last season. I mean, last season he was injured a lot, struggled, still got the 10 goals, but wasn't 100% healthy for a good chunk of the season. So just based on that, I think closer to the 16-17 season. But that year may have been his apex. I mean, he scored 26 goals. I mean, would I bet my house that he's going to do that again in Serie A? I'd probably say no. But could he be a 15 to 20 goal scorer consistently on a good team? Yeah, I have no doubt about that. So I don't think he'll be sold this transfer window, but I think if he has a good season, a team should definitely want to go after him. I've compared him a little bit to a young Gianluca Vialli. I still see a lot of parallels between the two. So I have faith that he's going to have a comeback.
And if anybody is going to play fantasy with us at Euro Fantasy League, I still think he's a great option because probably the top strikers on the top teams will be a little bit more sought after and expensive. So I still think Belotti would be a good get fantasy-wise. So, David, let's move away from football for our last Twitter question. Which directors use music and songs in the best way for their films?
Great question. You guys know I love movie and music questions. So I think Martin Scorsese is the OG. Maybe there was someone before, but he really used rock songs in movies incredibly well, dating back to his movies in the 70s. Now, I think it's getting a little bit played out with Scorsese. I mean, how many times can he use Gimme Shelter from the Rolling Stones in one of his movies? So I think, you know, he kind of goes back to his same wheelhouse a lot of the same songs and bands to kind of hit the same beats and give the same emotion to, you know, the people that look at his films. But he definitely deserves the credit, at least of those that I know, for starting this. Now, I will say I find Quentin Tarantino equally good at finding great songs to set the moods in his songs, but I think he's more creative. Like, he's not going to pick, like, you know, huge artists. He'll get some pretty obscure songs. I remember watching Reservoir Dogs and being like, man, so many great tunes on this that I had never heard. And I still listen to that soundtrack, same with Pulp Fiction. And then Tarantino, for the Kill Bill movies, brought in the RZA to do that soundtrack, which is awesome. So I'm going to give the crown to Tarantino as far as using songs in movies, because I think he took the Scorsese one and was a little bit more of a hipster, a little bit more variety for him. But then there are two other directors that I think use like pure soundtrack incredibly well. And that's P.T. Anderson, who's done a lot of movies, soundtracks with Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead. I think the last one for Phantom Thread is absolutely amazing. It's such a haunting classical music theme to it. And the other one has to be Nolan. I mean, the music in his films are like a character in it. So those are my picks. If anyone has any more, please tweet us with the CalcioLand hashtag. So I want to thank all our listeners. You guys are awesome. You are co-writers of the show with your amazing questions, but you're also our marketing department. We rely on you to spread the gospel of CalcioLand, and boy, do you guys deliver. We love getting tweets from people in Australia telling their friends about the podcast. Alex and I, as you know, put in a lot of work in these podcasts. We're getting to where we need to be thanks to your support. So we appreciate you being our marketing department. So now we're going to end this the podcast with a great interview with Richard Hall. We're going to focus on the two clubs from Milan, and we look forward to chatting with you all later this week. And for the interview segment of the podcast, I am thrilled to be joined by one of our favorite guests, a longtime supporter of the podcast, our great friend Richard Hall, calling in from the UK. You guys can read Richard's outstanding work on BTS Sport, ESPN FC, Guardian Sport, Football Italia, The Sportsman. He's often a guest on Sirius XM. And more importantly to me, he created the Gentleman Ultra, by far one of my favorite websites out there, because it really gets into the culture of Italian football. So he's a perfect guest for the topics going on this week. So Richard, it's great to have you back on. Welcome back to Calcioland.
Hi, David. It's always good to be back on this show. Always good.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's start with the hot topic of the day. Earlier today, Paolo Maldini, a return to Casa Milan, was introduced as a new director to the club. So let me ask you right up at the top, what was your reaction to Maldini's return?
I was a little bit surprised because he's rejected the courtship of Milan before multiple times. But I'm also thrilled for Milan because I think that his sort of character and the person he is and what he represents is perfect for Milan in this time of change. You know, under Elliott management, this is something now where they need to really recreate Milan, you know, and get back to what it's meant to be. And I think he's a huge asset in that, to do that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, what stands out to me about the best clubs in Italy in recent years, it always starts at the top. When you have a strong management team, strong ownership, usually it trickles down as well. So you mentioned that Maldini has turned down returning to the club previously. I think, you know, this is there's more certainty with the ownership situation. But one aspect that I find very interesting, and this is really in your wheelhouse because this is what Gentleman Ultra is all about, is the tension between Maldini and some elements of Milan's fan base. You know, for those not completely familiar with the situation, you'd think Maldini, an incredible club icon, played his whole career there. Not the best of exits when he retired, and there's been some tension since. So I can't think of a better person to give us some background on this. Your site has had some great articles on this, but you're an expert on the two Milanese clubs. So please tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Thank you for that, David. It's an interesting question because the situation with Maldini is that it's so hard to understand why certain elements of the Milanista didn't take to him and didn't like him in some respects. And I don't think it solely was the fact that they didn't like him. It's a long series of minor issues that bubbled up over the course of the years. And, you know, you're looking at a captain here that, you know, how many European Cups, how many Scudetti, intercontinental titles, you know, even the European Super Cups, Coppa Italia. The guy, the captain, he was superb. Now, you've got to take it in context in the sense of Baresi in that was a previous captain and had also seen, you know, Milan to a lot of those successes I just mentioned. And when Maldini came to the forefront after Baresi's retirement and really took on the captaincy, Milan, even though it was a gradual slow decline, were in decline. And the problem was, is that the Curvasur especially, you know, wanted someone who was going to come out and really, really back their thought process on the nature of the club. Some of the players who were coming in, he wanted to see them be more vocal. And Maldini's never been like that. Maldini is a person, is a very introvert, very quiet. You know, people know of his wife. You know, they know silly statistics about him. But realistically, he never put himself out there. Even controversially, like you may see Mauro Icardi doing, say, for instance, whether he unwillingly or willingly you know, can commit social suicide on Instagram. But, you know, this is a different era as well. And Maldini, one thing that was frustrating, whilst he didn't back the ultras in a lot of ways, he would take on the establishment, he would take on the issues of the club. Now, in fairness to him, I think he did criticise Berlusconi and the lack of spending and the way the club was looking at times. But he also criticised the ultras. And there was one incident against Parma where, you know, there was a stoppage in the game. The ultras were throwing oranges onto the pitch. They wanted it stopped. And Maldini spoke up against that. And he controversially went against them after a title win. And there's so many of these. So it's just a taste of the examples. There's him and Costa Curta. They won the title. The rest of the team were applauding. And Maldini was one of the first to go back to the changing rooms with Costa Curta. Not wanting to get involved with the fans as they wanted him to. And so the interesting, and the reason it's so broken and bizarre, and why Gazzetta dello Sport even many times had said that it was one of the strangest situations, is that there's been times when he's been criticised by the club, and his 900th appearance was probably the best little capsule for this, where he walked onto the pitch and there's people with, you know, T-shirts on saying, thanks, Paolo, great captain. But that's in the side. That's not, you know, the people who may frequent the Curva Nord even, you know, obviously aren't there. But the people who are just the general fans. And at the same time, at that backdrop, you had some jeers and you had some boos, especially at the end. And there's a banner that actually said at the same game, thanks, captain, on the pitch you're an undying champion. You had no respect for those who made you rich. And this was the banners from the ultras. You know, there's another one that said, for your 25 years of glorious service, you have thanks for those of you, you know, others call you a mercenary. And I just don't understand that banner in particular. But I think that on the pitch, the ultras couldn't fault him, but he didn't back them. The ultras at the time wanted the captain when they saw their club slightly decline to get on their flagship and go, no, this is not how it should be. And instead, he took a step back and he said what he wanted to say about the club in those situations. For that reason alone is probably why I think this is an excellent appointment, because he won't be swayed by the fan pressure. He won't be swayed by Elliott management. He will say what he thinks. And I think of all times, he does have the best interest of Milan at heart.
What a great answer. One of my favorite ones on the podcast so far, because it really is so specific to the culture of the Ultra. So for anyone who wants to learn more about this, because there's even more layers to it, there's a great article on Gentleman Ultra site by Richard Hinman that describes even more some of the situations that Richard discussed here. So let's shift gears to the pitch. Last week, Milan announced the acquisitions of both Gonzalo Higuain and Mattia Caldara. So let me get your take on those acquisitions. And do you see Milan as considerably improved compared to last season as of now?
Absolutely with this. I have to be honest, my first reaction when I heard about the arrangement of the deal and the swap was a shock. It took a while to realise exactly why Juventus would be motivated to do this, because on the outset, originally, it looks like you're almost giving away, in some respects, a proven goal scorer in Gonzalo Higuain. As we all know, he's broken the all-time goal-scoring record with 36 goals. And you're also giving away a prospect of Mattia Caldara, who, again, is a fantastic young centre-back and a fantastic young defender and can really, really improve. And the other way, you've got Bonucci going back, where there's been issues with Allegri. You know, to him to go back, he's going to have to be very, very, very humble in a respect and have to really think about how he's going to address that situation, because there has been issues. He's also addressing with his teammates of why he left and what happened, even though there are players like Chiellini there who will take him back. And also the fans, which is a huge thing as well. But on the face of it, you know, with the introduction of Cristiano Ronaldo, it makes sense in other ways. And it looks as though Juventus have done this because they want to win that Champions League now. That's the obsession. And Bonucci can help him get that now, because he's been there, he's done it, and he gives that experience along with the likes of Ronaldo. So, in hindsight, it makes more sense. But going back to the Milan point, Higuain, I mean, how long have Milan been missing a central forward like that? He can go and get him 20-plus goals a season. And Caldara and Romagnoli at the back, it's got a nice sound to it with Donnarumma there. You know, you're looking at the start. I mean, go back to Maldini and Baresi. You know, it looks like the start of another great Italian defence there. So, all in all, probably a good deal all round.
Yeah, yeah, completely agree with that analysis. Juve, too, it's not just for now. It was a lot of financial considerations on that. But for Milan, there's no other way to put it. This is a home run because Bonucci was going to leave no matter what after last season. So let's switch gears to the other side of Milan. And I think Inter, in a way, did too many moves too soon. And I think some fans are forgetting how impressive their summer window has been. You know, they brought in De Vrij, they brought in Nainggolan, Lautaro Martinez. They've really had a sensational window. And I think, you know, what happens with fans, it's all about what have you done for me lately. Then you see other clubs making moves and you're like, where's mine? But my assessment is Inter's had a great window, and I wanted to get your take on that.
I couldn't agree any more with that, because I was there in the last game of the season, that dramatic game against Lazio in Stadio Olimpico, and ever since then, they have ridden that wave all summer. And the next game, bizarrely, I went to after that was the game against Sheffield United over here in the UK. And the interesting thing was, is that even last season, you know, everyone's got to remember that Inter started extremely well until their sort of winter of discontent, in a sense, when between December and January, they didn't win a game. You know, Spalletti, should I say, was hamstrung in some respects. He's a coach who likes to change formation, likes to have a plan B. We all remember what he did at Roma. And instead, he found himself with a starting 11 that didn't change much unless it had to. They did exceptionally well for where they were last year. But getting rid of the likes of Davide Sanson, Vito Nagatomo, you know, these sort of players, even Francesco Bardi has been there for a long time. He's never going to do it if he's not done it now. They got the money from Condogbia, who eventually made that loan permanent. And you can list off more and more players like this who were never really going to make that impact at Inter. They've had the chance. For me, the good thing about this transfer window is they addressed every single key problem they have. You know, you look at that, Radja Nainggolan is probably the one that shocks me the most that he came over. He's working with a coach who knows him, who even knows his less appropriate characteristics. And if he can get him even 80% of the player that he was in the Spalletti at Roma, Inter have got a win there. Politano gives him extra cover on the wing, should I say, because Candreva was lacking goals, and Jan Karamo looks a talent, but still, you know, there's more to be done with him. He had developed this season. And more than anything, you know, you look at the fullback situation. The two fullbacks they brought in are, for me, probably the key point. Inter have had a phenomenally poor record with fullbacks, and this now sees them bring in some real elite quality. And one of the people I'm probably most excited about, and who looked absolutely incredible in pre-season, was Lautaro Martinez. You know, I was talking to an Argentinian journalist, Sam Kelly, who said that Inter have got an absolute steal with this guy. And the interesting thing is that his idol is Mauro Icardi. The other interesting link is that when Icardi came to Inter, his teacher, coach, mentor was Diego Milito. And when Lautaro Martinez was playing at Racing Club, same guy, same mentor. So there's a likeness of minds. They seem to have hit it off the pitch as well. And for me to see potentially, because Allegri's been, I can still not talk about Juventus. Spalletti potentially could start here with maybe a back five, and also there's a chance that he's been experimenting with that front two, and I think that's extremely exciting. So I think it's a really good window so far.
Yeah, so I anticipated some of the questions that I had, which is great. So the thing that stood out to me is, like you said, Nainggolan in a lot of ways is the sexy signing. And I like what you said. You know, maybe it's not the Nainggolan from a few years back, but with Spalletti, even 80% would be great. But the one that really stands out to me, and you hinted at it, is the wingbacks, because I find Vrsaljko and Asamoah are just such massive upgrades over what Inter had. And Asamoah, you know, both of them have played in Serie A. Vrsaljko has been gone for a little while, but I think that's really a big addition. Anything you want to add on the impact these two you think are going to have on the team?
Yeah, I think Vrsaljko in himself is just how he's grown in stature over the last couple of years. You know, he left Serie A. He left at Serie A with a lot to learn, and he's come back looking much more like the finished article. And Asamoah, he just brings, for me, he brings what Inter have needed, in the sense of he's got an engine on him, and he will go up and down that touchline, and he can deliver a ball in. He's still got the pace. And this is something that Inter have really lacked. I mean, it all goes back down to Icardi in some respects, but when you have Icardi isolated, when Kondrave and Perisic have had to pull into different positions at times, it had to defend quite deep as well, then it's taken, and Icardi also has had to come and pick up the ball deep. So all these problems, a lot of them do come from the fullbacks because they've not had the ability to go forward. I can't fault Danilo D'Ambrosio for his effort and his work rate and even, his quality sometimes in defensive positions, but that to play the way Spalletti wants, I mean, to get, the fullbacks into offensive positions because they've got the midfield to cover this now. They've got Niangalani who can make those runs and help the other midfielders go to defend. There's a lot there, a lot of promise for Inter, but again, just if you speak to any Inter fan and just say, what's the worst thing? And most of them will talk about the fullbacks and talk about crossing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let me ask you this. I think I know your answer based on how complimentary you've been about Inter, but I'll ask you anyway. Who do you think is the second best team in Serie A at the moment? I'm assuming you go on the assumption Juve is still a notch above everyone else.
Oh, absolutely. I think with Juve, everyone has to aim for second, and if someone can put in a title challenge off the back of that, then it's a bonus. I think I'm a little biased with that, but I think with Inter, they have strengthened more than I've seen in many a year. But I will say this, they're back in the Champions League, and that will take a lot out of them, and they're not used to that. And Spalletti's been still saying he hasn't got a deep enough squad. So potentially, yes, I do think Inter have got a good chance at that. I think Napoli, for me, still have... It's going to be interesting to see how they've got a transition to make. Everyone thinks that Ancelotti could slot right in there with the professionalism he brings. He could just give them a bit more of a winning mentality than Sadi had, and you could see them absolutely fly out the blocks again. But that's going to be an interesting transition to make. Milan with Higuain, potentially, with that goal threat, but I still think they've got a bit more to add to their squad, and maybe I'm not still 100% sold that Gattuso is a top level coach as yet, even though I do really like him. And again, Roma, I think there's two big losses in there. Niangalan, I think, is a loss. Alessandro is a huge loss. And they've got some fantastic young players in. But again, to me, that's development. So I don't think Inter just, have just gone out, done the transfer window, and it will be streets ahead of anyone. But I think by default of the transition of some of the other clubs, I think that Inter may finish second.
Yeah, I think they're the most logical answer. And look, you know better than me about Pazza Inter. It doesn't always translate to the pitch. But if you look at it now, to me, they are clearly the second best. So let's close on this. We hinted a little bit on the great content that's on Gentleman Ultra. And again, I've been plugging the site for years. I really can't say enough of what's on there. So tell our listeners what we can expect on the site in the coming months.
I've just got to always say, Luca Hodges-Ramon and Neil Morris are just doing an incredible job on that site. There's so many others as well who write. Emmett Gates has been brilliant and helped us done well with it. But at the moment, where we're up to is obviously the new site's all up and running now. It has been for some time. And we're also, the podcast is also out and been up and running. We just did our fourth episode to start this new season, so it's still in its early days. So those are exciting things. We're also trying to add more content this season. So we tried to do it a little bit on Twitter, tested out a little bit of a few vlogs when we're actually at the games, trying to get a bit more interactive with that so people can see and experience, even if it's just snippets of what it's like at those matches. We're also going to, when we're out in Italy a little bit more, we're going to try and get out of the site, so we can do more interviews with players, get a bit more live content again, whether it's from the Curva or wherever it is, just the entire experience of the game. So those things will all be coming. There's lots more in the pipeline as well. Just for UK, anyone in the UK, there's a fantastic bar that's opened called Golazzo in London, in Camden. We've got an affiliation program with those guys. You go in there and it's just 1990s games on, Italian football only. It's a really good project, so we're going to be working in conjunction with them too and probably hosting some events there as well.
Always such a pleasure to have you on, Richard. Your content is great in the articles and when you join us on the podcast.
Absolutely. I love this podcast. And thanks again, David. Always brilliant. And all your work, spot on. It always is. Always good to read it.